From the news centre at 5, the latest plan to get rid of Britain's binge drinking problem has been announced, and it's going to hit all drinkers in the pocket. The idea is to prevent shops from selling cheap booze in England and Wales by setting a minimum price of 40 pence per unit. Ruth Porter from the Institute of Economic Affairs thinks the proposals are short-sighted.
This is an incredibly unfair policy. The people it's going to penalise the most are responsible drinkers who are on low incomes. We need to be careful as well that we don't overstate the scale of the problem.
An alert's been issued over packs of painkillers which have been accidentally sold with much stronger tablets inside. Wockhardt UK manufactures a prescription-only drug called Cocodamol, but that version was accidentally packaged for sale over the counter. The Health Secretary has warned that doctors who are breaking the law by illegally authorising abortions will be reported to the police. Spot checks on over 240 clinics found that the physical and mental health of women are being put at risk, as some practitioners give consent without even meeting the patient. The cost of filling up your car has hit an all-time high. The AA says unleaded's broken through the £1.40 per litre barrier for the first time. Andrew Howard from the AA says motorists are gritting their teeth.
This is not a very healthy situation. The vast majority of the population are under serious pressure because of the rising price of fuel. Two-thirds of the £220 that people are meant to have gained in the budget would have been eaten up by fuel price rises by the beginning of August.
The average house price increased by just 0.1% in February, according to figures from the Land Registry. But sales prices for homes in the North West, the East, Yorkshire, Humber and the North East actually fell. That's the latest. I'm Katie Spencer.
Bristol Community FM.
Hello, Bristol, and welcome to BCFM's politics show, Friday Drive Time. I'm Tony Gosling, and helping us review this week's news is Labour Councillor for Bedminster, Colin Smith. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, can we trust this week's tale of the Toulouse assassin when almost all we think we know about him has come from his killers? Clouds over Syria too, with reports of European military officers aiding the rebels and Russian forces helping the government. Also, economic warfare against Iran goes up a notch. And is there really a nuclear weapons programme in Iran? Or is it just the Islamic values and culture that NATO is after? Plus, death by privatisation. Many are mourning the death of the National Health Service this week, and the Queen has been celebrating on the same day a public service in her Diamond Jubilee address. Also, the Americans are still droning on about peace. That's one of the better articles about this new technology of death by remote control, turning an obsession of teenage boys, the video game, into a murder. Without guilt as well, the disturbing new technology of drones. That's in the second hour after six. On to our news review in a minute, but first our two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 5 Celsius and dry. This weekend, highs up to 16. Sunnier on Saturday, but a little cloudy on Sunday. So don't go shopping on Saturday. Get out and about. Next week, highs of 16 Celsius. A lovely sunny week. Next weekend, that's the 31st of March and the 1st of April. Highs of 13 Celsius. Fairly sunny. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Well, time to introduce this week's guests, and joining me is Labour Councillor for Bedminster, Colin Smith. Hi, Colin. Welcome to Drive Time.
Thanks very much.
First of all, Colin, we've got the elections for mayor, or whether we're going to have a mayor or not, coming up instead of the ordinary local elections in May. Can you just give us an idea of what it means if we do go for a mayor system? How's that going to change the way politics works in the city now?
Well, primarily it's about leadership. Currently we have a leader of the council and a group of executive members who seem to make all the decisions that affect Bristol. With an elected mayor, the mayor is elected directly by the public and electorate of Bristol rather than by the politicians. And the mayor then forms his own cabinet from people who are not necessarily politicians or may come from all walks of life.
So if the cabinet is making decisions and or the mayor are making decisions, what's the point of electing councillors?
Well, you have to have checks and balances, of course. And if you look at the Boris Johnson situation in London, which I think is a very different situation from Bristol, the checks and balances still have to be in place, because those decisions which are being made by the cabinet and by the elected mayor still have to be scrutinised and challenged and sometimes overturned.
I think it's fair to say that most people don't necessarily understand how a mayor would intervene. But can you just give us an example, if we did go for a mayor, what kind of decisions might they make about, say, for example, policing? Although that's a separate subject, what would the commission?
I think that probably the better question is, for instance, what would they do about transport in Bristol? And I think that is a more interesting question, because as politicians, we've been demanding of governments of all colours in recent years an integrated transport system, not only in Bristol, but throughout what used to be called Avon. In order to make sure that our public transport improves and not festers like it does at the moment.
So what difference would a mayor be able to make in that sort of situation?
Well, I think that the mayor would be able to knock heads together, would have probably more power than currently the political leader of the council.
But, I mean, one of the first things we're going to be looking at this week, we may as well start right now, is what's happened in South Gloucestershire, because they've decided to go in a completely opposite direction, to have less power at the top and to go back to the old system.
It's very interesting, because I've only been a councillor with the current cabinet system in Bristol, but many of my older colleagues remember committee system, and they felt that all the 70 members of the Bristol City Council using the committee system had an input, and the issue is about scrutiny. How do we scrutinise and sometimes have the ability to overturn decisions that we think are wrong, for instance like the green spaces strategy, which was promoted by, amongst others, Councillor Hopkins. So the only way that we were able to challenge and overturn that was through the ballot box, when the Lib Dems, currently the largest party, lost the majority on the council. Otherwise, they would have hammered the decision through. So it's about scrutiny. It's about how we challenge decisions, how we make better decisions for the benefit of Bristol.
OK, Colin, what brought you into politics originally, though?
I'm an accidental politician. I worked in the background of community politics for several years. And I was out one day with my colleague Helen Holland, who said, "You ought to stand." And I said, "Stand for what?" She said, "Stand for the council." So I said, "Why would I want to do that?" And 10 years later, here I am.
Okay, but why the Labour Party? Why not one of the other parties? Because what we hear, particularly from young people nowadays, is the parties are all the same. Most of the policies at Westminster, anyway, are the same.
Well, I have to say that I come from a family that includes lots of coal miners. My grandfather was a coal miner. My great-grandfather was a coal miner, and so that my background is completely working class. I was brought up in Hartcliffe with socialist and Labour values, and I still have those values today. That's why I'm a member of the Labour Party, because I think that we are trying to make society better.
Well, that's almost implying that, say, the Conservatives, for example, aren't. And don't you think actually it's a bit of a confrontational thing? If you've been brought up with a trade union background, you're constantly niggling rather than actually managing and organising things.
Well, I think the interesting thing I've learnt since I've got involved in local politics was how closely all three parties, or at least two of the parties, work together on the council. And that I always describe it perhaps as being we're trying to get to the same destination, but we're taking different routes. My party has its own policies in terms of privatisation and the way that services are delivered in the city, and the Conservatives would have a different view of how you do that. So at least some of the people and politicians in Bristol want to get Bristol to be the best city in the country.
The argument is, usually, that at least the Conservatives, many of them have had experience running big companies, that sort of thing. That's the kind of experience you need to run a city like Bristol.
Well, absolutely. And I've got, I think that the Conservatives are sometimes very lucky in that the base of people they're able to draw from who ultimately become councillors. But the fact that you've been involved in business doesn't necessarily mean that you know how to run a local authority, which is a completely different animal to a private business. And I think some of the current Conservatives within the Conservative group on Bristol City Council have found that.
Okay, it's a big momentous week with the National Health Service. We'll be talking about that again in the second hour. But what are your thoughts about the Health and Social Care Bill passing this week?
Well, I think the thing is potentially disastrous for the future of the National Health Service. I think that the way that we're looking at private contractors being brought in to deliver some of the services is actually possibly going to lead it to some breakup of the National Health Service into smaller parts later on. And I think we're at the beginning of that particular journey rather than at the end. And I think I'd like to be here in 4 years' time, when we're talking in after a general election, to know what is going to happen with the National Health Service. I am very afraid of what the current proposals offer.
Well, it's all very well to blame the Conservatives and the Lib Dems for this, Colin, but this was a process that was started by the previous Labour government, opening more of these NHS services to competition.
Absolutely, and I don't disagree with working in partnership. This is the key, is private-public partnerships where the services are delivered for the benefit of the patients. But I think this is a step too far, where we're actually almost inviting private contractors and companies with vested interests to come in and take the services away.
Now it's probably a good time to bring in old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. Martin, on the National Health Service, one of the main driving forces behind this privatisation is the fact that government cannot afford to do things anymore. Like, for example, the brand new wonderful Southmead Hospital is a private finance initiative. The government hasn't got the money to do this kind of thing nowadays.
Well, I think that's just wrong-headed. I mean, the private finance initiative under New Labour or under the Conservatives is actually the most expensive way to do things. It's obviously much cheaper for central government to borrow money than it is for a health authority or an NHS trust. And in fact, it's actually what it means is the reason why it was brought in under New Labour was it means that it's not counted as government expenditure in the immediate short term, which means that you can claim that you're not spending the money because you're borrowing from the private sector, but it's actually a very expensive way to do it. And I don't want to start off by disagreeing with Colin, but I think that the door to this was opened by New Labour, wrongly so. And I think the case for having a properly planned service with central planning, with a proper plan of what you want to do, for example, forcing down the cost of drugs when you're buying from the private sector, the case for a National Health Service has never been overturned. It's the most efficient system in the world, and it's being smashed up.
But there isn't the money, I'm afraid. There just isn't the money anymore.
Well, as I just pointed out, doing it through the private finance is actually the most expensive way to do it, so that answers that one.
At least it happens. It wouldn't happen at all if it wasn't for that.
No, well, the point is that the National Health Service in Britain takes up something like 5% of our GNP. The system that the Tories admire in the United States takes about 15% of GNP, and 40 million people die in the streets with no healthcare. The NHS, the OECD, did a study a couple of years ago saying it's the most efficient system in the world. It's not the best, and it's not the best because we don't spend as much as the French and the Germans, but it's the most efficient. Central planning is more efficient and cheaper than the private sector. It just is.
You seem to be standing on its head what we're being told, that this is going to actually bring in efficiencies.
That's because there's an ideology involved here that the private sector is always more efficient than the public sector. Hasn't what's happened in the banking system made people aware, and also the mess on the railways, the mess of the private finance initiative in the National Health Service itself, they're still talking the same old talk, even though in actual fact the caravan has moved on. We are now moving into an era where the state will have to take much more responsibility than it has for a generation. It should never have been pushed out of these areas. Thatcherism, I don't know if you're listening out there in Radio Land, any Tories, Thatcherism was a disaster. And copying Thatcher 20 years further down the line is a double disaster.
OK, well, another privatisation which is looming is that which was announced just before Christmas, and that was of the Ministry of Defence Procurement. This is a big, big thing in Bristol, obviously, because we've got lots of employees. Around 10,000 people work at the Filton Abbeywood base, and it was on page 14 of the Evening Post on Tuesday, tucked away right at the end, and it never appeared on their website for some reason. But this is the story. The Ministry of Defence has revealed it's talking to various companies about the possible privatisation of its massive Abbey Wood Centre. As I said, 10,000 people work in Filton at Abbey Wood. It's responsible for sourcing and supplying equipment for all three of Britain's armed forces. The base is the largest Ministry of Defence centre in the country, and the government has admitted it's taking a close look at the way it runs the operation. Now, the options for the future include creating a trading fund, which would be used to create a separate company, and Abbey Wood could become a non-executive public body or a quango, also possibly a government-owned company. Now, some of the companies that have been being talked to about this include Serco, Babcock, also who do major engineering projects. Also, major finance firms including Deloitte and KPMG have also been consulting, along with the Bechtel Group and Fluor Corp, which is F-L-U-O-R. Also, BAE Systems, which owns Filton Airfield and employs hundreds of staff in the Bristol area, are also taking part in the talks. Martin.
Well, I mean, again, it's just ideology, isn't it? They want to privatise everything that they can possibly can. It seems that they are determined to push through a more extreme privatisation programme than was attempted in the 1980s, purely on the back of the fact that they think that they can get away with it. And the problem with any government spending on military expenditure is it is a huge cost overruns. We covered this previous weeks, all of the corruption in the contracting process. Billions are lost to the taxpayer every year through cost overruns and messes created by privatising and contracting out military production. My view on military production is if you're going to produce military stuff, it should be produced by the government, and everybody should know exactly what it costs so that nobody makes any profit out of it. And if nobody's making any profit out of it, there's no pressure to produce more military stuff than you actually need. And of course, it's a huge money spinner. All of these companies are going to be paid by the taxpayer. This, to call this private sector or free market, is ridiculous. Every penny spent will come from the taxpayer. It'll just go into private pockets.
Now, Colin Smith, you're a Labour councillor. Does it ring any alarm bells for you that BAE Systems may be involved in overseeing these defence contracts?
Well, absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, I completely agree with Martin, but I think there's another aspect to this, which is about the integrity and security of the defence infrastructure, which is, you know, pretty fundamental to the safety of this country. It strikes me that what we're seeing from this government is we're moving into areas where they're now doing what we used to call the unthinkable. Some of the more radical and, dare I say, idiotic ideas, we're now actually seeing the current government giving a bit of legs to. So I agree with Martin. I think it would be a disaster.
Well, idiotic, that's a bit of strong word. Why do you think, you know, why do you use such a word about this?
Well, they seem to be flinging their arms up in horror to try and find some ways of what they think is saving money. But as Martin points out, the more likelihood is that they're actually going to spend more money. And actually, some of these companies are not even British companies. They are multinational countries, and actually we're putting our defence funding into the hands of global companies. And
now, Martin, one of the discussions we had a few weeks ago with Andrew Feinstein, who wrote that brand new book, which is probably the first out for about 20 years on the global arms trade, in his book's called The Shadow World. What he was saying was that actually BAE Systems are at the heart of global corruption in the arms trade.
Indeed, and therefore you've got BAE Systems who are getting, if they, for example, got the contract to run Abbey Wood, they would get taxpayer money, which was, of course, it's a guarantee. You know, there's no real competition involved in this. Once you've got the contract, you've got it, and then you build in cost overruns, so it ends up costing a lot more than was originally bid. And of course, you can't change it halfway through. It's defence, you know, everybody's got to be vetted. And then BAE Systems will no doubt give the Tory party a massive subvention for their election funds. And this is exactly what goes on in the United States of America. It's what Eisenhower called the military industrial complex. So you've got private companies profiting from public contracts to build military equipment, and then using the profits to pay for more of the same by buying the political process. It's very, very pernicious.
Another privatisation. I'm sorry, we got there's three so far. We hardly started. This week, there was an announcement about privatising the motorway network and privatising the roads to get the country moving again. Britain's major roads could be privatised, and a new generation of motorways funded by tolls under plans to be announced by David Cameron. And also, it's interesting because the N.M. Rothschild and Sons, a big city institution, actually said proposed this back in 2009 to all the major political parties. Colin, what are your thoughts about motorway privatisation?
Well, I mean, I think that the issue here is about raising the funding to relieve our congested roads. I mean, I was going up to Gatwick on Sunday, and like Monday, the road was completely congested, the M4. So clearly, we've got a problem in terms of trying to relieve congestion. The problem that this government has got is actually trying to raise the money to relieve those roads. I've never been in favour of toll roads. I wouldn't use the M6 toll road on principle myself. I think it's a system which is pernicious. I think it's detrimental to many of the motorists in this country who pay enough for their vehicles. So I think that what Cameron is doing, he's floating an idea to see how it might float, and I think we might see something in it, but I don't think we're going to see a lot.
Well, some people might actually call the whole sort of system of tolling around all around the country a kind of medieval type system, but ultimately something's got to be done to keep these roads maintained.
Absolutely. And what we see is that our roads are no longer coping. If you want to go to Heathrow, for instance, and you want to be there by 8 o'clock, you can never guarantee that you will, even if you leave at 5, that you're going to get there, because the road will be congested, or it will be blocked, or there will be some roadworks on it. And I think that is a serious problem for this country in terms of our roads and our transport infrastructure.
Yeah, you could always take the train.
Yeah, and pay the price that the current private companies want you to pay, £196 return to London.
I think that's right. I mean, basically what they're trying to do is they need to improve the infrastructure. They don't want to spend any money, and they want to give some contracts out to their chums, so they're floating this idea.
But this,
I wonder if the Jeremy Clarksons in the saloon bars around the country are going to be that happy about getting their checkbooks out every time they get on the motorway. It might die because of their opposition.
But it does look like this policy has been totally made up by the NM Rothschilds and Sons, and this is something that's just come straight from the city.
Well, the whole idea of getting your infrastructure paid for by the private sector, with the private sector taking the contracts and all the fees and all the rest of it, is very much in line with everything else that they're doing. But haven't people realise that the banking system, the financial system, is a system of robbery, basically, and you don't actually want to extend their fingers into any more areas? What we really need to do is spend money on rebuilding the infrastructure, the roads, the railways, everything, an integrated process. We need to reboot the economy. We need a new deal for the economy, and that, of course, we are not going to get
that
from these
like
free markets.
That sounds like a real gimmicky phrase.
Well, it was a gimmicky phrase used by Roosevelt in the 1930s, the New Deal, and it's the only thing that broke the back of the Great Depression. And we're going to have to do something very similar eventually. And what they're trying to do is to try everything else apart from the obvious solution, which is for the government to pick up the ball and run with it.
I'd like to explain what the New Deal it would be then, another New Deal.
Well, the New Deal is based on the idea that we are in what is called a liquidity trap in technical terms. That means that private enterprise is not really interested in investing as the economy goes off the cliff. And we've just seen this. I noticed you've got it in here because I sent it to you earlier in the week. Britain's deficit actually rose by twice as much as expected in February, because that's what happens when you cut public expenditure. The deficit gets bigger. Not that many people realise that, but they're going to realise it as we go forward. Ultimately, what you have to do is the government has to be responsible for managing the whole of the economy. That doesn't mean abolishing the private sector, but the private sector will not pick up the ball and run with it unless the government does so. In the US, they've had a half-hearted attempt to do this, which has been subverted by Wall Street insiders around Obama. But ultimately, the only way to get out of this recession, depression, crash that we're possibly going through is for the government to actually take responsibility and have a plan. And that includes raising the money by raising taxes if necessary. And that is the only thing that saved the world in the 1930s and 1940s, and it's the only thing that's going to work this time. But they're trying everything else but the right answer.
Well, you say a liquidity trap. Can you just explain that in layman's terms?
Okay, a liquidity trap is simply this. If you're a private sector investor and companies are actually sitting on quite a lot of money at the moment because they've been building up their resources, there is no point whatever in investing in new plant machinery and training new people if there's no demand in the economy. It's a waste of time. And therefore the private sector waits until the government gives the economy a kick, primes the pump, starts the lawnmower, and then the private sector comes in to pick up the contracts that the government is giving out, as we saw earlier with the Ministry of Defence and Abbey Wood. Now, the Tories believe in crowding out, which means that the more public spending there is, the less private spending there is. Now, this was touted in the 1980s. There's no evidence for it whatsoever. And basically, the public and the private sectors are interdependent. If you look at most private companies, including BAE Systems, for example, most of the demand that they actually satisfy comes from the taxpayer, comes from the government. They pretend it's a free market, but it isn't. BAE Systems could be a nationalised company, and in actual fact, that might be more efficient and we'd all be better off, because it's not a free market. And that's the point, is that the government is, in fact, ultimately responsible for managing the economy. The Tories don't believe that, but they're going to be given an economics lesson by reality as we go forward. As the deficit increases, the economy falls off a cliff, and the private sector does nothing, because the private sector won't. They're only motivated by private profit.
Now, Colin Smith, you're a Labour councillor. Can you just explain why it is we got into this mess? Because we hear this again and again, that this whole financial crisis was set up when Labour were in power.
Well, absolutely. I think that if you look at the roots of the financial crisis, actually it was in subprime lending in America, for which some of our banks actually joined in and then caused a crisis. Now, you can do lots of things, and I'm not an economist or a financial expert, but it seems to me, and I've been to the new swimming pool and the new hospital in South Bristol this morning, and actually, you know, what Gordon Brown did by spending money, trying to spend our way out of the financial and banking crisis, was we ended up with new hospitals and new schools. That's what people seem to forget. They seem to imply somewhere along the line that the money's gone into some black hole and gone in the pockets of bankers and financiers. Actually, it's been building new hospitals and new schools right throughout Bristol.
I think that's not quite true. I mean, some of it did go into the pockets of bankers, well, and still is, I'm afraid.
Yeah.
But of course, we did. There was some positive stuff as well.
Absolutely.
One of the problems here, of course, Martin, and something you flagged up fairly regularly on here, is the fact that the quantitative easing money, a lot of this money that's now going to prop up the banks, is actually being used to lobby, to actually change the law in favour of even more deregulation.
Yeah, Milton Friedman pointed this out years ago. He said, once you've created a state bureaucracy, like we've now got a private banking state bureaucracy, once you've created it, it then lobbies for more of the same. Because they're then in a position, I mean, the banks claim to be making profits on the back of Enron accounting, frankly, but then they use those profits to pay politicians. I mean, the Tory party, there's a recent study, half their money comes from the City of London hedge funds, half the money, and they've got far more money than all the other parties put together. That explains an awful lot of why we're getting policies from the City of London, doesn't it?
Now, Colin, we've had the budget this week on Wednesday, and one of the most important things to do with that seems to be, anyway, I mean, it's very difficult to pull all these things apart, seems to be that the tax breaks for the super rich. Now, this is exactly the opposite of what Martin has been calling for, which is actually the super rich, many of whom have done incredibly well over the last 2 years, should be
and continue
made to
do
pay.
So.
What's your take on the budget?
Well, I mean, I think it's a budget for rich people, really. And if you look at the 4.5 million pensioners who've lost out, that's where we should be looking. And when we've had a drop in the top rate of tax from 50 to 45, simply because some statistician is telling George Osborne that we're not raising enough money. Not that we're not raising any money, but we're not raising enough money from the 50p limit. So I think that that the people who are currently benefiting from the economy, and these are people who are have millions in the bank, they are continue to prosper, and they will prosper under George Osborne, because he is not addressing the issues that ordinary working class and ordinary pensioners are worried about, which is what's the price of milk and where's the next loaf of bread going to come from.
But Martin, this drop in the top rate of tax from 50p to 45p, we're told, will only lose around about £100 million from the Exchequer. So it's an incentive on the rich to actually go out and do more with their money.
No, the reason for that is because it was only brought in recently, and they all basically got their tax accountants to pay themselves in the next year, so that they wouldn't have to pay much in the first year. So there's a reason why over time it might actually bring in quite a lot of money. It's all based on something called the Laffer curve. I mentioned crowding out earlier, which was a popular economic theory in the 80s, which has proved to be completely wrong. And I'm also mentioned the Laffer curve. Now, Arthur Laffer was an American economist, and he came up with this idea: if you tax rich people too much, they evade tax, and therefore you get less. And he drew a normal distribution curve. So the idea is anything above 50%, you start to lose money. But there's no empirical evidence for that whatsoever. The actual rate at which you start to lose money on tax is about 70%. But during the 1950s, in both Britain and the United States, the top rate of tax was 96% and 92% respectively. And those were the days when you could leave a job in the morning and find another one in the afternoon. And living standards for ordinary people went up through the roof. They haven't risen for ordinary people in the Western world since the 1970s. Meanwhile, the top 1%, as they say in the protests in the US, the top 1% have been making out like bandits. That's because they are bandits. And they come up with all this Laffer curve stuff. It's been absolutely disproved. The crowding out theory has been absolutely disproved. They were disproved in the 1980s. I used to teach economics in the 1980s, and my students were taught, we had to teach them all of this stuff, and we had to teach them why it wouldn't work. And they're coming back with exactly the same stuff. They've even got a Laffer curve, apparently, in the budget statement, even though it's been disproved for 30 years. That just shows how out of touch they are, doesn't it?
I think one of the ways that the things in the budget is going to hit people more than anything else, or at least certainly loads of people are going to be hit by this, is the fact that the fuel duty is going to be rising up another 3p now. Diesel's already banging up against £1.50 a litre. How does that actually affect the economy, Martin?
Well, the way the energy price increases affect the economy, it doesn't cause inflation because the demand is so inelastic. If you're driving to work every day, you've got to drive to work every day and you have to pay that price. So that means you've got less money to spend on other things, which means, of course, demand is being drained out of the economy. And at a certain point, there's going to be another financial panic, because that's what happens if you carry on cutting public expenditure. Tim Geithner from the US, who is actually a bit of a bad guy, but he was actually hinting to the Europeans and to the British, if you carry on cutting public expenditure, you're going to regret it, and they are going to regret it. As I said earlier, and I think we've got it in here, the deficit rose in February. We've got the actual figures here. Here we are. The pound falls after UK deficit comes in way worse than expected. This was from Bloomberg, which is a sort of financial magazine for top people. The big spike in February borrowing. Total borrowing came at 15 billion. Expectations were for a deficit of just 8 billion. Okay? So we've got a nearly doubling of the expectation. Now, this just may be a one-off, 1 month, but I suspect it's not. And that in actual fact, as we go forward, the cuts policy that's being pursued by the government will increase the deficit. I used to teach A-level economics, and I would say to my students, why will the cuts policy increase the deficit? And the smart ones would be able to give me the answer, and they'd get the A's, and pray George Osborne would get a C.
Now, the fuel duty going up, before we get completely off that subject, we're talking about £1.50 for a litre of diesel. Now, going back to a story from a couple of weeks ago about Iraqi oil. Now,
Iranian oil or Iraqi oil?
No, this is Iraqi oil. Costs $1.50 a barrel to get out of the ground. Okay, you've got to refine it. But actually, this is a complete and utter difference between the cost of actually getting the oil out of the ground and what we're paying at the pumps. Now, who's taking that along the way, apart from just the government?
Well, it'll be the oil companies and the shareholders in the oil companies, who are, guess what, the big financial people in the City of London and Wall Street. Basically, the price of oil has been, in 2000, the Wall Street lobbied for the Commodities Future Exchange to be deregulated. And up to that point, you could only really buy futures on oil, like buying a barrel of oil 5 or 6 months ahead or whatever, in small amounts, because it was just supposed to kind of create a sort of levelling mechanism that allowed you to hedge against big fluctuations. But the oil price has been rising steadily since the deregulation of the Commodities Futures market, because people were not interested in buying a barrel of oil. They are speculators who are buying a piece of paper that says they want a barrel of oil in so many months' time or years' time. And that's why the thing has gone through the roof. And where does all that money go? It goes back to the pockets of Wall Street, the financial bigwigs and so on. So they get it. They're the ones who take all the money off it.
But Colin, ultimately, people have got to pay these prices. They don't have a choice, really, do they?
Well, no, they don't have a choice. But what you will find is, take me, for instance, I now consider every journey that I make. So my car might do 8,000 miles a year, whereas when petrol was a pound a litre, it might have done 12,000 miles. So I think that people are making choices. They're making choices how to spend their money.
Yeah, and for some people, that's a harder choice than for others, isn't it?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
OK, on to our next story. Baroness Miller has withdrawn her amendments to a bill to criminalise squatting. This is a peer that raised opposition to a bill that will criminalise squatting has withdrawn her amendments on the promise that they will be introduced again at a later juncture. That's Baroness Sue Miller, who retracted tabled revisions to Clause 136 of the Legal Aid, Sentencing and Punishment of Offenders Bill, and that relates to squatting, even though squatting isn't actually mentioned in the title of the bill at all. What are your thoughts, Colin, then, about the criminalisation of squatting?
Well, I have to confess I'm ambivalent about it, because I think that what we should be doing is we should be looking at the buildings which are potential for people who want to squat, and actually trying to bring them back into some sort of effective use that addresses the issues that squatters have, which is homelessness and sometimes, you know, some of the other social ills which are affecting our city. And if you look round our city, you know, you take, for instance, the building in Stoats Croft, which has been empty for 25-30 years, still being argued about as how it's going to be developed. So it's about, as I say, I'm ambivalent about it. I don't believe in squatting per se, but I believe that we should be actually looking at our city and bringing back the resources to address our social issues.
So if you find yourself homeless, you think you should just sleep in a doorway?
No.
Martin, what are your thoughts on this one?
Well, I mean, again, it's knee-jerk stuff, isn't it? Squatting has been legal in this country and a civil offence since the Middle Ages. And various attempts have been made to say that it's illegal for people to go. You know, they've looked at it loads of times. And it's so ingrained in English common law that if there is an empty building and nobody else is using it, as long as you don't damage it, you have some rights in law to use that building. And I think it would be a great shame to lose that safety net for people who are really struggling at the bottom. Also, of course, I remember people I used to know who squatted in London in the 70s, and they took over derelict properties, did them up, and eventually became housing cooperatives, because they instead of being punished, they were supported to do what they were doing. And ultimately, of course, I agree with Colin, we actually need a crash programme of social housing building. Why not council housing? Why? Mm. Build a council house? What a
There's
terrible
a novel idea.
What a terrible idea. But of course, if you've got a burgeoning... that would do two things. One, it would put people to work and put demand into the economy, including construction workers who get laid off immediately as soon as there's a downturn. It puts people in houses, which means that they've got a reasonable rent, which means they can go out to work for a reasonable wage. And also, of course, it lowers property prices for the property buying classes. And I think that's terrible. No, it's not. In other parts of Europe, people don't imagine that their house is going to rise in value over their lifetime. So at dinner parties, middle class people chat about what businesses they've been setting up and what new ideas they've got for industry. Talking about their house prices is a waste of time, because house prices are stable, and that's actually a good thing. Not a bad thing.
Okay, well, let's go to the House of Lords now, because I've got a little
Speaking
clip
of houses.
I recorded on Wednesday evening when this debate took place. I just find it incredible that these things are happening. This was actually happening. The debate started at 10 to midnight on Wednesday, of course, so there's no journalists there. They've all gone home. Even the live feed from the House of Lords on the internet dies at midnight, so you only get a little bit of it. And so these people are chatting away with nobody actually able to hear them online anyway. So let's have a listen before the feed cut at midnight what they were talking about.
In committee, the noble lord, the minister, said that the government wants to send a clear message to existing and would-be squatters. Well, to my mind, there is too much legislation about sending messages, especially when it's a message that involves criminalising a vulnerable group of people. But I fear actually what this is, it's not about sending a message to squatters. This is about sending a message to the right-wing press, who have conducted a misleading and pernicious campaign on this matter, demonising homeless people in the process. My Lords, I would like us to send a message tonight, a message that we are willing to put ourselves in the shoes of homeless people for whom squatting an empty property offers a meagre lifeline, and that we oppose this nasty little clause. So despite the lateness of the hour, if the noble Baroness, the Lady Miller, did choose to test the opinion of the House on one of her amendments, I very much hope that noble lords would be willing to support it.
My Lords, in some circumstances I might have hesitated to support the amendments that have been tabled this evening by the noble Lady Baroness Miller of Shulthorne Damer. But in the circumstances in which we find ourselves, circumstances in which the government have made drastic cuts to new provision of social housing, circumstances in which the government have introduced reforms to housing benefit, which will cause significant numbers of people to lose their homes, I can only support the amendments that the noble lady has proposed. I do not think that it is right to criminalise, as she describes them, vulnerable homeless people who seek to find a roof over their heads in empty properties in these circumstances.
That was from the House of Lords late on Wednesday evening. Now, Colin Smith, you're a Labour councillor. The argument here really is that there is already civil recourse. If somebody finds that there's somebody squatting a house that's maybe been empty for 6 months, they come, they turn up, they find someone squatting it, they can go to court and get people out. So what's the point of criminalising this and making it an immediate criminal offence?
I can't see, frankly, I can't see any point in criminalising it, because I think that ultimately squatters will probably end up in jail or some form of confinement where we end up paying for them anyway. So I can't see any point in criminalising it. I don't think it addresses the issue of how we deal with the issue of squatting, other than, as Martin said earlier on, provide more social and affordable housing.
Well, certainly if you look around the city, it looks like squatting may be becoming a bit of a boom industry, since there's so many buildings that are, in fact, it's Cumberland Street, I think, where the old Bristol hub used to be, the homelessness centre. The entire street is now boarded up.
That's irony for you, isn't it?
Now, Marina's joining us.
Hello. We will talk about Afghanistan. The number of British soldiers killed in the Afghanistan conflict is now more than 400. American losses exceed 2,000. More than 12,000 Afghan civilians have been killed in the last 6 years alone. There is also a worrying trend of suicide in returning veterans. About 10,000 Afghan soldiers and policemen have been killed. There have been more than 5,500 wounded UK soldiers, including 241 amputees and many more from the ASIS coalition forces. British soldiers have been killed at four times the rate of the United States soldiers. Estimated Taliban's casualties since 2001 are more than 40,000. But these are the bold statistics. The pain is shared by people, widows, children, and families of the dead, perhaps none more so than Mohammed Wazir, an Afghanistan civilian. He lost 11 relatives, his wife, his four daughters, two of his sons, his mother, a brother, a sister-in-law, and nephew in the last week's mass shooting, allegedly by out-of-control United States soldier Sergeant Robert Bowles. WikiLeaks have published many mainly United State Army mission report involving civilian casualties. You would not expect soldiers to freely admit to killing non-combatants. They are recorded as a killing in the action, which has often been started by United States forces. When your coach in crossfire near your home, does it really matter who fires the fatal shot? Most civilian casualties are young, powerless and illiterate. All that their shocked family can do is bury them. Nevertheless, studies have claimed that about 77% of casualties are caused by the Taliban, implying that 23% are caused by coalition and Afghan troops. How reliable these statistics are is questionable, as the source data no doubt comes from the one side only. According to Tony Benn, all war represents a failure of diplomacy. According to the Taliban, Britain's is American's stooge regime and British soldiers are puppets. America eventually joined Britain in the World War I and World War II only when it was directly attacked. But it did, for example, provide arms on generous terms to a desperate British whose army had lost most of its equipment, evacuating from France through Dunkirk and was under threat of imminent invasion. America effectively forced Britain out of Egypt in Suez Crisis, one of the final nails in the coffin of empire, and reluctantly provided a limited backing during the Falklands conflict. Britain has supported America led NATO wars in Korea, Iraq twice, Afghanistan, and bombed Libya in the action apparently linked to enforcing a no-fly zone, but declined to support America in Vietnam. America will act in its own self-interest. Perhaps the puppet politicians of America's stooge can learn a lesson for the future from Vietnam. What do the people of Bristol think about Afghanistan? What are we achieving in Afghanistan? Is it worth the price in lives?
To be honest, I have no idea what we're achieving in Afghanistan. I don't know really what we set out to achieve. It's worth the price from either side. But yeah, I don't think it's terribly clear. From my point of view, we went to war with Iraq and it all just kind of blurred into one big war, and I don't think we're achieving much. Certainly not from stories still coming from there. And
people still not thinking very clearly. It's not gonna be safety when the guys from British coming back from there here. It's absolutely, it's gonna be more trouble, more child, more woman just going to be dead. It's better the soldiers of United Kingdom to stay there to make more safety of there, which is Iraq is same as like Afghanistan, which is...
No, I think you might want to call me a conspiracy theorist, but I believe that a lot of world affairs are orchestrated events, and really what's happening is illusion as far as we're informed officially.
Yeah, nothing much really. I don't think we should be there, really. I think it's their affairs and we should stay out of it.
We're not achieving nothing.
Pain, isn't it? Pain and death.
I don't know, we should never have gone over in the first place. It was on false pretensions of like weapons of mass destruction, and it was never found. No, we shouldn't be over there anyway. Russia was over there for 10 years and they didn't achieve nothing.
President Karzai of Afghanistan wants foreign troops out of villages now. A complete handover on security responsibilities by 2013, not 2014. More work on reconstruction and financial support. Should we agree?
Yes and no. Yes, because it would be great to get out of there and have left something that's sustainable and something that works. But at the same time, I think once you've gone into Afghanistan or any other country for that matter, you've got to take responsibility for those actions and you've got to follow it right through. I was in Bosnia 2 years ago and I was learning about the war in the 90s in Bosnia and how they were, you know, they're still so angry with the UN for not going in and doing something, and when they finally did, it was poor until something really happened. They made a lot of mistakes with that. So I can understand going in somewhere for civilian need to start off with, but at the same time, I think that will just lead to more and more war. And in some cases, it can get better and it can work, but, you know, come out with some dignity on both sides.
I have no objections.
Yeah, I think he's president of his country, Afghanistan, so he should be able to outline what is needed and when.
Yeah. More people, more soldiers are going to get killed in that time. So we should be over there anyway. Because they stand by what Americans do a lot.
Politicians don't know how to think for themselves. They let America do their thinking for them. So we should just pump a load of money back into the country that we've destroyed and get out.
Afghanistan is more than 3.5 thousand miles from the UK. Do we have defence interests so far away?
I don't know if we do. I can see why things have happened as they have, and I can see why we went in there originally to a certain extent. But as I say, it all kind of got blurred into one a bit, so I'm going to say no.
I think everyone on the planet has got an interest in cooperation.
Only oil and protecting our interests in oil.
No, I don't think we should. We shouldn't be. I don't think we should be over there anymore. I think we should just concentrate on our own country. And they're doing cuts all the time. And if anything happened to this country, we're always sent everywhere across the world. And I just think we ought to just sort of concentrate a little bit more. A lot nearer anyway, and definitely not Afghanistan anyway.
Again, unless people are coming onto this shore, then we've got no reason to fight thousands of miles away from home. It's all political, it's all money, and that's just the way it is, isn't it? We shouldn't be there full stop.
Well, I mean, we heard the opinions there, Tony. I think the British people have long ago decided that the war in Afghanistan is a pointless war, including many soldiers that I speak to and ex-soldiers. But the politicians are talking to themselves.
And the media
talking to themselves about this. I think that they're way out of line. The mainstream politicians, including in the Labour Party, are way out of line with what ordinary people think about this. They've long ago decided it's a waste of time.
The trouble is, of course, isn't it, that how can you pull away from something like that? You've invested so much time, so many, as we're hearing, just 400 of just British servicemen have died out there.
And lots of civilians, which we don't hear much about. I mean, this guy just killed 16 last week. I mean, how are you going to call that back? I mean, the Taliban, frankly, are winning. They are winning. That's because it's their turf. If somebody invaded us, I expect we'd win. And they've got a very, they're massively experienced. They smashed the Red Army. They were all trained, of course, by our own people in the 80s under Operation Cyclone. I think the problem is, you see, like in Vietnam, what point do you chuck the towel in and admit that you've lost because you lose face and all the rest of it? And as John Kerry, who was a presidential candidate in the US, said, who fought in Vietnam, he said, how do you explain to the last man to die that it was all a mistake? And that's why they can't back off. But of course, the people who are losing face here are politicians in comfortable offices. I think it's time to face reality and just end it.
Colin Smith, you're a Labour Party councillor in the city. Do you think we've come to the end of the line, or is it really a point in staying in Afghanistan at this point, 10 years on?
I think part of the problem is that we, when we went in, we didn't have a plan of how to get back out again. And having, hopefully made the country, dare I say, safe. So I think there is going to be a tipping point. I don't think we've actually reached it yet, but I do think in the conscience of the people of the UK is that those soldiers' lives are in the forefront of, and families are in the forefront of everybody's concerns.
Martin, one big consequence of this, of course, is a massive rise in the opium crop.
Yeah, well, the Karzai government, we all know, stuffed the ballot boxes when Karzai was elected. I mean, he is supposedly the elected leader of Afghanistan, but of course it was a far more fraudulent election in Afghanistan than we've just recently seen in Iran. And the Karzai family, his brother Wali Karzai, was named by the DEA as the biggest drug dealer in Afghanistan, also on the CIA payroll. No surprises there. In the Vietnam War, the American military encouraged the Hmong tribe in Laos to produce opium in order to pay for their arms to carry on fighting the Pathet Lao. So these things are messy, which is why fools rush in where angels fear to tread.
But what we're told is that one of the main reasons for being there right from the start has been to stop the terrorist training camps.
Yeah, but there aren't any. I mean, they've admitted, listen, there are all sorts of questions about that. In Pakistan, I read the Pakistani English language press a lot. Nobody believes a word we say about anything. Basically, the people in the West who are very, very inexperienced politically and militarily, they are being bamboozled by their own leadership. If you look at people who are educated and readers of English in Pakistan, they frankly don't believe a word we say about anything, and they are much better informed than we are.
Okay, on to our next story, and our Chief Constable of Avon and Somerset Police, Colin Port, is going to be appearing, we're told, next Tuesday at the Leveson Inquiry in London. That's on March the 27th. He confirmed to the Evening Post that he has been called by Lord Justice Leveson, who continues to investigate media culture, practices and ethics and the press's relationship with the police. Now, this is specifically to do with, it's highly likely that Mr. Port will be asked questions about the Joanna Yates murder investigations carried out in late 2010 and early 2011. The media coverage of the arrest of Miss Yates' landlord, Christopher Jeffries, ended with The Sun and the Mirror newspapers being fined for contempt of court and eight publications paying Mr. Jeffries damages for defaming his character. So this may be something interesting to watch, Colin.
Well, oh, absolutely. I have the The I actually was interviewed by the police over the Joanna Yates thing, because as Lord Mayor, I was back and forward to the Mansion House quite a lot, and clearly it happened in that particular road. I think it's a really interesting case, which I was quite disappointed at the time that the way it was actually handled, and certainly the way that Mr. Jeffries was dealt with by the popular press was absolutely disgraceful.
The allegation here is that the police actually said to, off the record anyway, to these newspapers that they'd got the guy, basically, and that's the allegation, Martin.
Well, yes, and I think they're probably regretting saying that now, aren't they? But, I mean, it raises bigger questions about how the police deal with the press in general. Because, of course, as you know, journalists like to be in with the police because they get lots of stories out of it. But that puts them open to manipulation by the police. And then relationships between the police. And, I mean, as David Cameron said in the House of Commons the other day, if people are paying police officers for information, he can't see any circumstances in which that would be right. And I think I agree with the Prime Minister on that one.
Well, decisions about public statements by the police are not made by ordinary officers, but at Portishead's police headquarters by media relations manager and the head of corporate communications. So it might be interesting to see them in front of Leveson too.
Well, especially if Colin Port didn't have anything to do with it, and it was these people lower down the chain who did it all.
He is their line manager, basically. You know,
so he is responsible.
The communications people.
I think it's a whole can of worms, and it isn't finished yet. And I think we're going to see some quite surprising things come out of it. But hopefully, what we will see come out of it is greater integrity by all parties concerned.
Yeah, maybe a bit more accountability. Police officers, are staying on the subject of the police, are to vote on the right to strike plan. Rank and file police officers to be asked whether they would want the right to strike. The Police Federation said all 135,000 members in England and Wales will be polled in the wake of a 20% budget cuts and major reforms in pay and conditions. Well, Colin, this comes on the back of last week and the week before stories about private police stations and talking about privatising police force.
Well, I think I mentioned the word unthinkable earlier on. You know, when you talk about private security guards patrolling our streets instead of PCSOs, I think it's actually ridiculous. And actually then goes back to issues of integrity and security. If you're paying a private company to run a police service, you know, what standards of integrity are we going to get?
Well, we may get better technology. We may get better investment in policing.
Possibly, but I doubt it. I mean, I've got a lot of respect for what the job that the PCSOs do. And actually, they are paid in terms of the overall pay that policemen are paid. They are paid a pittance for what they do. And they are the ears and eyes of the police service, patrolling our streets on a daily and hourly basis, and I think they do a great job.
But isn't it almost unthinkable that the police could go on strike?
Well, yes, I do. It would be a very, very difficult step to take. But we're in very difficult times, and certainly for me, when the police are talking about trying to find the right to strike, suggests that politically that they've perhaps fallen out with their friends in the Conservative Party.
Martin?
I think that's right. I mean, I remember back in the 1980s, and one of the first things Margaret Thatcher did was whack up police pay, encourage them into believe that she was on their side.
And the army.
And, well, and of course, we never had so many confrontations with the army. We don't live in Ireland, but I mean, I was on picket lines in the 80s, and of course there was a great deal of needle between workers who were on strike and police officers, because there was clear, you know, they hated us, we hated them. And I'm glad to say that we've moved on a great deal from that period. There's a much different attitude all round, and if you're going to have a major social crisis, which we are having now, we saw the riots over the summer, it's very important that the police are properly resourced and also seen to be above the fray on everybody's side, not just there to bully around poor people on behalf of rich people. And I think the fact that they are not very happy with the way that things are going, just from an operational point of view, not just money they're worried about, they're worried about whether they can do the job properly if they don't get the resources. And I think it behoves ordinary citizens to listen to what they're saying. They shouldn't have to go on strike. It should be, you know, the thing, their grievances should be addressed.
But these proposals signal the end of a job for life, as Mr. Windsor called for the ban on chief constables making officers redundant to be lifted in the face of budget cuts.
Well, exactly. It's the whole concept of public service. People used to join the police force and expect to be in there all their lives and know that they would have to deal with whoever they'd sent to prison when they came out 10 years later and all the rest of it. So it's all about trust and relationships.